I'm Danny Alexander, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Performers from across the metro had their names up in lights in 2016. So today, we revisit conversations with those actors and musicians who entertained us this year, both in Kansas City and across the globe. First up, the actress who took on the complex role of Blanche DuBois in A Streetcar Named Desire. Then, a tale of two singers, one a world-class opera tenor, and the other a vocalist who can sound just like Billie Holiday. Finally, we end the show with the smooth jazz of Bobby Watson, who composed the theme music you're hearing now. We spoke with him right after his return from a performance at the White House. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Danny Alexander, in for Steve Kraske. We're ending our week of conversations from 2016 with the local performers who wowed audiences here in Kansas City, across America, and around the globe. We begin with the local actress whose portrayal of Blanche DuBois in A Streetcar Named Desire was described as brilliant by critic Robert Trussell. Cinnamon Schultz took on that role, considered one of the most challenging in American theater, and Steve Kraske spoke with her before Streetcar debuted in September.
Well, A Streetcar Named Desire won Tennessee Williams the Pulitzer Prize for Drama back in 1948, and many critics consider it his masterpiece. A lot of people, in fact, consider it one of the best plays ever written by an American, and the character of Blanche DuBois is front and center in the play. Actress Cinnamon Schultz is taking on that role in a Kansas City Actors Theater production of the play. She joins us now, and welcome. It's so good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, Blanche DuBois is a huge role for any actor to take on. She is really the axis of this play. How did you prepare for it?
Well, I'm still doing that, actually.
Are you?
Yeah. Yes.
Cramming?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's equivalent to basically like a mountain climber climbing Mount Everest.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's so much to her, so much. I started probably about a month before we started rehearsal just researching the time period and different aspects like possibly mental breaks and domestic violence, things like that. You know, happy stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a role that's so loaded with expectation. You know, think Jessica Tandy, Vivian Leigh, you know, Shirley Knight twice, Glenn Close. So many great actors have put their stamp on this character. Mm-hmm. Does that history affect how you play her?
No.
Really?
I mean, I hope not. Mm-hmm. I know that wonderful, great actresses have portrayed her before.
But this is Cinnamon Schultz's take.
This is, well, yes, and also plenty of help from my director, Sydney Garrett. I utilize her guidance a lot, and the words of Tennessee Williams. I mean, you can't veer from those, and they tell so much about who she is. So I hope that I do her justice. But I can't think about what the other actresses did. So,
what are you bringing new to the role?
I don't know that there's anything new that I can bring to her. Mm-hmm. Just bringing her back to life is the best I can do.
Tell us about her for folks maybe not familiar with her. Describe her to us.
Well, she's something you might call the quintessential Southern belle.
Mm-hmm.
And she grew up on a big plantation in Mississippi. And now she's come to visit her sister in New Orleans, and it's a huge culture shock for her. Mm-hmm. She's also a school teacher, so she's educated, and she's surrounded by a lot of people that are not. And that kind of difference in the way people are is really affecting her. I don't want to give too much away because I would love for people to come see it, but there's a lot about Blanche's past that haunts her and affects her.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, you've worked with Sydney, the director, a lot in the past, and I'm wondering, does that help bring this character and the play to life?
Well, it helps me trust her. Mm-hmm. Our relationship, we've worked together so many times that I completely trust her and her ability to keep that vision of the whole show so that I can just concentrate on my part and she's got the overall vision. And she can make sure that I'm staying true to Blanche and not bringing too much of my own personality into it. so to speak.
It strikes me that it's so easy to judge Blanche, not just for what she's done before the play starts, mm-hmm. but for how she behaves during it. She's in denial about a lot, and I'm wondering, how do you get the audience to relate to a character like that?
Well, her denial is a way of hiding, but it's also a way of escape. And so I think as much as she might fib, so to speak, she wants to be true. She wants to be the person she's trying to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, she is being truthful as much as she possibly can.
She's trying to keep it together.
Yes, at all times. From the beginning to the end, she's always trying to hold herself together. And I think that the audience can relate to that because everybody's been through situations that might be stressful. And you might want to just run and scream, but you've got to keep it together.
You know, for local theater goers, Cinnamon, you're a familiar face. You're always very involved in the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival. You were in 12th Night just this year.
Mm-hmm.
How does this role compare to others you've been playing recently?
Well, it's extremely different. Extremely different. The role, for instance, that I played this summer, Mariah, in 12th Night, was nothing but fun. Just complete fun. Who would hang out with the guys on stage and play practical jokes. Absolutely nothing like Blanche.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a lot easier then for me as a actress in rehearsals to just have fun and play around. Blanche is pretty much all-consuming.
Mm-hmm.
At home, my kids know that I will always have my script in my hand right now.
When did you start working on it?
I started working on the script. Well, I started reading it several months ago and just rereading it. And then I started to break down the text about 2 months ago. So
break down the text means?
Well, taking it line for line, basically trying to figure out what exactly Blanche means when she's saying certain things. Is she meaning what she says or does she mean something else? So,
how about the process of memorizing something like this? I don't understand how you guys do that. Never have.
Yeah, it's different for every actor, I think. Some actors are able to memorize before they start rehearsal, which is great. I wish I could. But for some reason, I have to wait till I've walked through a scene and looked at the other actors. And then I go home and just start trying to go over it and over it and over it again and again in my own head and out loud. And that's how I memorize.
That sounds like work.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of work. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's been decades, I think I'm right about this, that since A Streetcar Named Desire has been produced in Kansas City. Why is that?
That's a really good question. Maybe because it is such an iconic show that sometimes people might not think that you're ready to take it on. It's also a larger cast, so it's harder to produce sometimes with 10 people in it. I feel very thankful that Kansas City Actors Theater is taking this on.
The play was written almost 70 years ago. Why do you think it still resonates today?
It's so prevalent, honestly, just because of the relationships that you see on stage. One of the biggest things, unfortunately, we still have to deal with in today's society is domestic violence. And that's really around the play, the relationship between Stella and Stanley and how Blanche can't understand that. And so I think that's extremely relatable. Also, just people losing themselves can be relatable as well. Mental illness, domestic violence. And that, I mean, when Tennessee Williams wrote it, it modernized the stage. And so that's why I think it's still completely relatable now.
How does Blanche lose herself?
Well, it starts when she's really, really young. Heartbreak is a big reason. And loss.
Mm-hmm.
Loss of, well, through death, many, many deaths. And the loss of just everything around her, it feels like. And so when everything, she starts to lose everything, that's why she starts going into her make-believe world, so to speak.
Hmm. You've said that the KC Actors Theater, which is putting on this play, mm-hmm. makes an effort to keep its productions pretty simple.
Yes.
Is that the case here?
Yes. Kansas City Actors Theater also always wants to focus on the story itself and let the actors just bring out the story. And that's happening here as well. I mean, yes, you can't get away from all the props in the show. There are poker games, dinners, lots of stuff, but still focusing all on the story itself.
Just quickly, you come from a theater family.
I sure do.
Tell us about it.
My father was a theater professor, and my mother was a music professor, and they would co-direct musicals together. So I definitely grew up around the business. There was no avoiding it.
That's Cinnamon Schultz. She's playing Blanche DuBois in this Kansas City Actors Theater production of A Streetcar Named Desire. Thanks very much. So
Thank
good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Steve Kraske spoke with Cinnamon Schultz in August. Ben Bliss took up singing to support his film hobby, and now he's a tenor singing alongside icons like Placido Domingo. He was raised right here in the heartland, but his voice has taken him around the world.
Well, here's an unlikely path for you. Prairie Village to the Dr. Phil show to the Metropolitan Opera. Got that? That's the journey Ben Bliss has taken as he makes his way up the ladder as a rising tenor in the world of opera. Ben Bliss, of course, isn't the only opera sensation from Prairie Village. The great Joyce DiDonato is a Prairie Villager as well. Ben Bliss, welcome to Up to Date. So
hey,
good to have you back in town.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here. Always good to be back.
What is it about Prairie Village, Ben?
Oh, man, who knows? You know, I mean, this is a point that Joyce has spoken to in with a lot of force in the past, and that is the support of arts and public education here. And that's something that I got a really good dose of when I was a kid growing up at Belender Elementary School in Indian Hills and Shawnee Mission East, and I think that has a lot to do with it.
That path rings a bell in my household as well.
Oh,
so
good.
So you know Joyce, obviously.
Yeah, we met for the first time at the Met a little over a year ago, and when I was in college, and I was just kind of getting my feet wet in the opera world, I went to go see a Met broadcast of The Barber of Seville with Juan Diego Flores, who also sang in this Harem and Jewel series in 2002, I think it was. And at the intermission, they always have the stars come on and talk, and she came on and said, "Hi, I'm Joyce DiDonato from Prairie Village, Kansas." And I about fell out of my chair. I was in Southern California at the time, and I was like, "What? Prairie Village, Kansas? There are like 10 people from Prairie Village. Come on."
Yeah, right.
And
right.
Yeah, and so we met at the Met a couple of years ago, and I had my introduction already. I was going to say, "Hey, Joyce, I'm Ben Bliss. I'm from 74th and Belender." You know?
what did she say? I bet she laughed.
Well, you know what? She actually, I came in and I said, "Hey, I'm Ben." And she goes, "Ben Bliss?" And I was like, and I'd been in an opera competition in New York, the Tucker competition, and had won an award, and she had seen on the website that a tenor from Prairie Village had won, and so she had my name in her mind, which was kind of a thrill.
You know, help me here, I'm a little confused. You're 6'4", you're skinny as a rail. You don't look anything like these Italian famous opera superstars we've come to know over the years. What's up with that?
Well, you know,
you don't fit the type, Ben.
Yeah, I can't tell you how I ended up being over 6 feet tall, or why the other guys ended up being, you know, that wide. But you know, I think that that works to my advantage, and the genesis of the opera world continues. It's got a lot more competition from movies and Netflix and these kinds of things, and so it's becoming more of a visual art, and so people, you know, are looking for a certain visual aspect to accompany, you know, great singing. So, you know, that hopefully that's worked to my advantage.
You know, help me with this career trajectory you've been on here, Ben, because you got a degree in film from Chapman University. Then you spent 2.5 years working on the Dr. Phil show, okay? Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you decided to try a career in singing. Let's break this down a little bit. Why film and why Chapman University?
Well, it all started at home. My dad is a freelance cartoonist, and my mom, Judy, she sings in the opera chorus in Kansas City,
sure.
Has for years and years.
Yeah.
And so I grew up with music in the house all the time and going to see my mom's operas on Sundays, and I just was not interested. Not really my thing. But in high school, I was in choir and enjoyed that, and football was always my thing. Still a huge Chiefs fan. Joe Montana was my hero.
You know.
But in high school, I was 6'1", but hadn't quite filled out yet. I was like 120 pounds, something like that. So
playing it wasn't going to happen.
I played for like a year and a half, and it turned out that was not as downhill stream as I would have liked it to have been. And so I got really into theater, and that opened the door to film for me. And I was really, really interested in the visual storytelling process and wanted to go to film school. And to do film school, you should go to Southern California, it seemed to me. That's where all the action is. And to pay for it, I figured my best shot at a scholarship would maybe be a music scholarship to sing, because I had some success with that in high school. And so that's how I ended up at Chapman. They offered a choir scholarship, even if you were not a music major. And they assigned me a voice teacher there, which I was not planning on. And my sophomore year, Patrick Gazer is his name. He's a phenomenal, phenomenal mentor to me. And he said that he was going to lower my grade if I didn't try out for the opera.
No kidding.
And so I tried out, and they cast me as Tamino in the Magic Flute. So here I was, you know, going to sophomore film classes and carrying around a 400-page Mozart score with me, learning 2.5 hours of German music.
And you weren't really into operatic music at that time, or am I wrong about that?
Well, that was sort of how I got into it. Once
you
I did the Magic
to it,
Flute,
yeah.
I really enjoyed that. The combination of, you know, difficult music, but that seemed to fit my voice well. And I'd taken some German in high school, and so I had a leg up there, and I just really enjoyed the challenge of it.
For people who don't naturally gravitate to opera, what did you like about it, Ben? What was it that began to light you up about it?
Well, for me, it was really being, at the beginning anyway, being involved in it and doing it and being a part of that process, because I always enjoyed the theater and being on stage and the process and sort of the magic behind the scenes and everything.
Right.
And as time went on, doing Mozart and then Benjamin Britten, composers that are separated by 200 years, you really start to see during the time of being invested in those scores the juxtaposition of them and how they're similar and how they're different and how the styles have diverged but kept the same bones, and how they build off of each other and how playful they are. That's what Mozart is something that luckily I think for me sits well in my voice, and so I sing a lot of Mozart. And one thing that I love about that is people think of Mozart as this, you know, an ivory bust of this white-haired, brilliant genius. And, you know, that he was. He was a once-in-a-millennium genius, a really incredibly brilliant guy. But he was a total party boy, you know? Mozart was a total party boy. He was, you know, he died broke because he spent all of his time partying and goofing off. And that's one of the reasons he died early. He got sick. And he was a young man when he wrote most of these operas. I flew in yesterday from Atlanta, where I was doing a production of Abduction from the Seraglio. And in that, the main tenor character is in love with a woman named Constanza. And what I love is while he was writing this opera, he's about 25 years old, and he was too broke to be living on his own. So he was living with a former violin teacher who had a daughter named Constanza, who he was falling madly in love with and ended up marrying. Hmm. And so there's all these arias in there, these aching love songs about Constanza. And, you know, that's not some white-haired genius who's been dead for 200 years. That's just some 25-year-old guy who's fallen in love and happens to have, you know, a miraculous mind.
So you graduate from Chapman, and you were still sort of aiming towards film at that time, though. You weren't doing the singing thing right away.
Right.
How did Dr. Phil happen? Because it took a long time to even to get on that show, and you were kind of began as an errand boy, basically.
Yeah,
you?
Absolutely. Well, if I learned one thing in college doing music and film and trying to get all this stuff done at the same time, I feel like I really learned how to hustle. That's what I always tell young singers, is that, you know, nobody's going to come and knock on your door and offer you this or that. And so, I graduated from school, and I was still solidly aiming towards a career in entertainment the whole time. So I moved, I didn't quite move to LA yet. I went up to the public library and printed out a list of all the bars in Hollywood because I just finished bartending school because I realized my film and music degree wasn't doing everything that I had hoped it would.
Yeah.
And so I went from door to door, all these different bars in Hollywood, and ended up getting a call to work at one that was across the street from a studio, which was perfect. And so I, you know, serve up the suds and the chicken wings to all these studio guys and just talk to them and kind of hustle them. And finally, these guys said, oh, I work for Dr. Phil. And I said, well, you taking interviews? And they said, well, yeah, you know, here, email me. So I emailed the guys like twice a week until they got me an interview and got the job. So I was an errand boy. Despite all the hard work, I wasn't quite kind of making the money I wanted to make to just be comfortable. So my third year, I managed the on-air promo department for their spinoff show, The Doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And we shot six shows a week, and I had to sort of wrangle my staff to deliver a set of on-air promos every day. And I think I was like the fourth person to have that job in about 8 months.
Wow.
So did it for a while and wasn't super happy. So I found the opportunity to leave, called my voice teacher from Chapman before I left the studio. As I was walking out the security, I just said, well, Patrick, I think I'm going to give this singer thing a try.
Yeah, what made you think that was the big reverse course in your life, Ben? What made you think about trying singing again?
Well, you know, I kind of missed it. I always really, yeah, really enjoyed the craft of it. And I hadn't done it for a while. And I thought that maybe that door would still be open. And Patrick had always been really, really encouraging. He, you know, as a tall tenor, he always said, oh, there's no tall tenors out there. And he thought my voice was particularly well suited to it and that I had the sort of the drive and the ambition to really go after it. And so he said, you know, I often have to tell students that they might have to have a day job to support their singing habit. And he said, you might have to have a singing habit to support your film, or you might have to have a singing job to support your film habit.
That's
and so I thought, oh, well, that would give that a try, see what happens. And, you know, it went pretty well.
Tenor Ben Bliss is my guest. So then you end up doing this series of auditions for the Los Angeles Opera that culminated in the appointment to sing for Domingo, the great singer. No pressure there, right?
Yeah, right. Actually, surprisingly, I was nervous going into it, but once he came into the room, all of the pressure disappeared.
It's a great guy.
Yeah. I mean, people ask me, oh my God, what was he like? I mean, honestly, with all due respect, he was like Santa Claus. He came in and he was like just this smiley guy and came over and put his arm around me and said, hey, what will you sing? And I said, oh, I'm going to sing Ecco Ridente from The Barber of Seville. And he goes, ah, Ecco Ridente. And he starts singing it because the pianist was a few minutes late. So he says, hey, sing with me. So we're singing.
Oh,
he goes down
kidding.
And sits down at the piano and starts playing it. And we're just kind of goofing off singing this. And the pianist walks in. And so then I did the audition, and it was, he really, really
took
the chill out
of it. Well, that took the pressure off a little bit, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It was a really warm, warm environment. And then second, he said, we will hear you sing No Puede Ser. And that was an interesting one because when I was at Chapman and Patrick was telling me, you should consider being a singer, I said, all right, well, I'm gonna look into this. So I'm gonna do my research. So, you know, what do? You go download the Three Tenors CD, which I paid for. So.
Ah.
But I was listening through it and was thinking, oh, maybe I could pick out one of these tunes and learn it. And the one that jumped out at me was Domingo singing No Puede Ser, which is from Zarzuela, which is like a Spanish sort of musical theater, soap opera, operatic
yeah.
drama. And I sang it all the time in college because especially my senior year, I was back doing mostly film stuff. And
so you were comfortable doing it for him then?
Yeah. And,
yeah.
You know,
he
I
liked
sang
it
a million times. Yeah. And I sang that and he said, I approve. And,
did
and it was really cool to sing the song that I heard him sing and kind of motivated
oh, yeah.
me and then get to sing it for him. It was pretty cool.
He's been pretty supportive ever since too, hasn't he?
Yeah. He's, in addition to being a real phenomenal vocal talent, obviously with some serious longevity, he's really, really dedicated to nurturing young singers. And he's such a great people person. He
yeah.
still remembers my mom every time she sees him backstage somewhere.
Oh, that's
How
great.
Is your mommy? Is your mommy here?
Really? Is that what he says?
He's awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you were talking about Mozart a minute ago, and I want to play some of you singing Mozart here. You've called Mozart the supreme puzzle master, and of him you've said this, Ben, everything he writes, no matter how sensual the melody, is underpinned and supported by this incredible musical structure that the singer has to observe. That structure is in everything he gives you to sing, which is one of the reasons I love Mozart so much. Explain the importance of that structure to me. And keep in mind, I'm a layman here. What does that mean?
Well, to me, in Mozart's music, there's always... It comes from his personality that I was talking about, I think. There's this playfulness to it,
yeah.
And there's this motor underneath where it's always driving forward, and there's some psychological energy in it. Because in addition to being a great composer and knowing how to write for the voice, he's this incredible dramatist and human being, and you can always feel that in there. And so there's this structural motor to it, and also this human motor to it that makes it so easy to access, and also shows you... Mozart's music to me always sounds so alive. It almost plays itself. And even within that structure, there's always room to wiggle and to interpret.
That's interesting.
It's
What's
so
the
fun.
Piece we're going to hear here? Do you know?
I'm not sure. If it's it might be O wie Ängstlich, which is from the opera I mentioned.
Well, let's listen. And if it's not, we'll correct it on the other side, okay?
Perfect.
Did we get it right?
Yep, that's the one.
Boy, that's spectacular.
Oh,
it's just
thanks
amazing.
A lot.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I should point out, I just met your wife backstage. You performed with her when she was then your fiance. I assume you've done it as she's been your wife as well. She's a bassoonist. You're a brave man to be performing on stage with a wife like that. Is that tricky or not?
Oh, no. We're always looking for a chance to do it because,
yeah.
You know, one of the tricky things about this profession is that there's a lot of travel involved. So, you know, I was just in Atlanta for a month and going to be in five different cities doing this recital. And then I go to New York for 5 weeks over Christmas, which is great. You know, you don't get bored. You're always seeing something new, but... A chance to perform together is a chance to be together in the same place for an extended period of time, which is all I'm ever looking for.
Ben, what a pleasure to have you here. I wish you all the best down the road. Keep going, man.
Thank you very much. It's
Make
great to
Prairie
be here.
Make Prairie Village
Thanks.
Proud, okay?
All right, you got it.
That conversation originally aired in October. It's time for a break. When we come back, Steve Kraske talks with the Kansas City native who brought Billie Holiday to life on stage this past summer. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. We'll be off Monday to observe the New Year holiday, but KCUR will bring you special programming from Intelligence Squared.
I'm blue. My disposition depends on you.
Jazz singer Billie Holiday's career ended infamously in a haze of drugs and alcohol, but her music continues to inspire others today. Vocalist Nedra Dixon portrayed her in a Spinning Tree Theater production in August, and she spoke with Steve Kraske about the attraction of playing the famous Lady Day.
What drew you to a story about Billie Holiday? Because this is not a happy story, necessarily.
It isn't. Well...
Parts of it.
Parts of it are not. The known parts. We know that she had a life that was infused with drugs and alcohol and abusive men. But she had this amazingly beautiful gift that has made her an icon in music. She's left a legacy of song and a style that is unlike any other. And Andrew Parkhurst and Michael Grayman approached me in the fall about doing this piece. And I said, oh my goodness, yes. I'd known of it from years ago when it was first done back in Atlanta and New York first. Mm-hmm. And it's a fascinating 90 minutes, and it's also an Olympic marathon for the artist that has the privilege of portraying Billie Holiday. So I feel very honored to have this opportunity.
I'm just wondering about Billie Holiday's life. And you know, you mentioned this extraordinary gift that she had.
Mm-hmm.
And yet so much pain and suffering with the booze and the drugs and then the men, too. What happened? Why was that going on to a woman who had so much part of her life?
she had a difficult childhood. She was brought up in and worked in whorehouses. She was abused sexually when she was a young girl. She didn't have a dad present in her life most of her life. So things that we know of today that there's, you know, a lot of help with out mm-hmm. there. You can go and get some counseling or treatment in a center. Things were not available like that mm-hmm. in those days. So you coped. And so drugs, alcohol, abusive men were certainly coping mechanisms. And part of, I don't call hers a tragic life. She was a survivor. She made choices in her journey that certainly most of us might not make. But she had passion for her gift. She loved to sing. It made her world. And she was so very talented mm-hmm. and had opportunities, too, to display that talent and was received with open arms by humongous audiences all over. So her life wasn't tragic in the sense that she didn't get to do what she wanted to do or that I find that the real tragedy, if we want to label a tragedy in her life, was that her cabaret license, her work license, was revoked by New York State when she was convicted of a drug possession crime and sent to federal prison. And at the time in New York, when there was a very hot time for club action in New York, so there were places to work all over the place, and she was very much a top performer in New York City, constantly on the boards. Well, that ability to work was taken away from her.
Ouch.
By the state.
How much of her life, Nieder, did you understand before you took on this project? Or did you have to really dive into the biographies and figure her out?
I read her autobiography and several biographies. There's a lot written about her. Mm-hmm. Although there's a lot that's still questioned, is something the truth or not? I listened to recordings. I let them wash over. I go to sleep with earphones in my in my ears to get her style, her cadence, her breathing, her placement in singing. I'm not doing an impersonation of Billie Holiday in the show. I'm hoping that the spirit, the true spirit of her, is what you see on the stage.
What was it about her voice and her singing style that made her the legend that she remains even today? And I also wonder, how surprised would she be to know that in 2016 we're still talking about her contributions here?
She had the ability to sing truth and to paint a picture with lyrics and make an audience see what she was and feel what she was talking about. Mm-hmm. She didn't have a very large voice. She didn't have a great extended range. You know, if we were to compare her to some of the young people, say, on American Idol or The Voice today, where we're listening to voices that
jump
all over the place. And hers did not do that. And that isn't what captured and captivated an audience. But I would dare say if she were singing in 2016 on The Voice or American Idol, that we would be compelled to listen
really?
To her.
Really? Yeah. Do you think she'd be surprised that we're still listening to her today?
No, I don't think so, because her way of communicating was to sing. Mm-hmm. If she were, you know, she expressed the joy, the necessity of singing. So I think she would understand that people would want to hear what she had to say.
Yeah.
And she had the power to put us right in the middle of her hand.
I always, you know, got to think that someone like you, Nieder, who spends as much time as you have with Billie Holiday, if you had a chance to sit down with her today, I'm sure there are lots of things you'd like to ask her.
I would ask her, she passed when she was 44, and I think I would ask her, were you satisfied with everything in your short journey that did you accomplish what you hoped to?
She died of what?
She, well, alcoholism had terrible effect, and her liver was destroyed, and it affected her heart as well. So, you know, once your systems get affected by everything, then and she died. She didn't have money when she died, so she was in not great circumstances. And actually, the play, Lainey Robertson is the playwright. This is an imagined piece that he came up with that takes place actually in a small bar in Philadelphia just 4 months before her death.
So, and she's sort of back with friends again, right? Mm-hmm. This is sort of her home, and she's back.
She's and happy to be there. Happy, to be performing, because it's at a point in her career where she's not being sought after. Mm-hmm. And, of course, not being able to perform in New York. She didn't have the venues to work. So she's having to drive to Philadelphia from New York, because she was still living in New York, and get a gig. Mm-hmm. And but she was overjoyed being there. She says this is the intimate club setting was where she thought she lived.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're given a bit of every night.
You were saying a little while ago just how demanding this role is. Mm-hmm. What, an hour and a half is just you.
Yeah.
You know, that is...
It's truly an Olympic marathon.
Good luck. It feels that way to you?
Oh, absolutely. I come off and I'm exhausted because everything... I do have the blessing, thank goodness, and the cushion of two musicians, musical director and pianist Gary Green, who has a bit of a speaking part in the – he plays the accompanist Jimmy Powers at piano. And there's – he has some lines to do in the show, and then we have a bassist, Julie Danielson. But it's just the three of us and all me as far as the music, and there's 12 numbers in the show as well as all the monologue work. It's a lot.
How long did it take you to wrap your arms around it?
Ooh, well, they gave me the script and
don't
I
say
said,
20 minutes.
No. Not at all. Yeah. I started work on the script right at the first of the year in January, and I broke the script down into six sections, and I gave myself a deadline to have each section memorized by. And I had the end of the script deadline was I should have all of this done by July the 20th of this year, because I knew that my rehearsals were going to start fairly soon. But I was able to get it down by March. But
oh, wow. Wow.
But it was with a lot of – I worked every single day for several hours a day in memorization and in singing and in listening so that I could channel her, so to speak.
Hope you hold up okay, Nita. Yeah,
I'm having the ride of my life. It's a fantastic opportunity, and I'm going to cherish every performance.
Good for you. That's Nita Dixon. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Nedra Dixon joined us back in August. Our last artist is one listeners of this program know well. He's the composer of our theme music and a jazz instructor at UMKC. It's saxophonist Bobby Watson. Back in April, he played for President Obama for International Jazz Day. Steve Kraske caught up with Bobby the day after he returned from Washington.
Bobby Watson joins us right now. Welcome home.
Thank you, Steve.
How was it?
It was great.
It
was a bucket list moment.
And what did you think of it? I mean, here you are playing for the president.
Well, just how many layers there are in the production of it, and in terms of even security, getting vetted, and getting on and off the grounds. And
they were changing acts out pretty quickly up on stage. I was thinking you had to move a little bit.
Yeah, and the stage crew was very, very well organized, and the whole production, how it came together, it was very impressive.
You dressed up. You look pretty sharp up
there.
I was very impressed. Yeah. I bet you saw a lot of old buddies as all these greats from all over the country, all over the world got together for this evening. It must have been a blast for a guy like you who's been doing this for a while.
Yes, so many old friends and acquaintances.
Like who were you seeing that was just a kick for you to spend time with?
Terrence Blanchard, Christy McBride.
Trumpet player,
Terry Lynn Carrington.
Christian McBride was just here in town. I just talked to him.
And then Pat Metheny. We ran into each other. We hadn't seen each other in quite a while.
Lee Summit, Pat Metheny.
That was great. Yeah. We've been knowing each other since we were teenagers.
Is that right?
And so we had quite a few conversations reminiscing and bringing ourselves up to date. No pun intended.
Thank you.
Just many guys over the years that have known me and seen me grow.
Was it a fairly relaxed event? Because you only had to play a couple songs, it looked like to me, and unlike a full-length concert, so you had time to sort of chill and visit?
Yeah, it was relaxing. And my highlight was getting to meet the president and first lady. Mm-hmm. And we did a master class hosted by the first lady that morning. And for the music students in the Washington, D.C. area, and it featured the Thelonious Monk Fellows that go to school out there in California. It was quite a experience.
You know, playing for the president and the first lady, I mean, did you have a chance to visit with them at all, or was it just going through a line, or how did it work?
No, he came by. It was very personal. I met Michelle twice.
Mm-hmm.
She's very personable. They're both very elegant and very classy, and it was just wonderful to see the president. And we all took a group picture with him, and then he insisted on shaking each other of our hands and visiting for a moment with each one of us.
Yeah.
They expressed their love and appreciation for jazz in ways that I knew came from the heart.
I was going to say, and we're going to listen to the president speak in just a moment here, some of his remarks. It's clear this music really had some impact his life. He talked in his introduction as the event began about his father. He had a very limited relationship with his dad, but his dad took him at age 10 to hear Dave Brubeck, and he said it changed him.
Yes. Yeah, and Michelle's father had a big listening room, you know, of jazz. And so they both grew up with it. They're not just paying lip service to it. Jazz is a part of their life and of their background of sound.
Let's listen to just a few moments of President Obama introducing the crowd to International Jazz Day Friday night at the White House.
Jazz is driven by an unmistakably American spirit. It is in so many ways the story of our nation's progress. Born out of the struggle of African Americans yearning for freedom, forged in a crucible of cultures, a product of the diversity that would forever define our nation's greatness. Rooted in a common language from which to depart to places unknown. It's both the ultimate in rugged individualism, to get out on stage with nothing but your instrument and improvise, spontaneously create, and the truest expression of community, the unspoken bond of musicians who take that leap of faith together. There's something fearless and true about jazz. This is truth-telling music. And jazz is perhaps the most honest reflection of who we are as a nation. Because after all, has there ever been any greater improvisation than America itself?
You know, Bobby, I'm going to steal a word you just used a few minutes ago, elegant. That was maybe the most elegant description of this music I've ever heard. It really caught me as I was listening to it online yesterday, just sitting at my house.
Yeah. Yes.
What a beautiful thing to say.
Yes.
Clearly from the heart.
Yes. There. It was a moment, you know, that I was happy to be a part of many. So it was wonderful to be there.
As you're sitting there performing, and you, I know sometimes the lights are bright, but you're looking out in the audience, maybe you can see a couple of rows, and there's Barack and Michelle Obama sitting front and center in the first row.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a little distracting?
I was trying not to look at them too much, you know. But there were a lot of people there, you know. Reverend Al Sharpton was there, the former Attorney General was a few seats down from them.
Yeah, Eric Holder.
Eric Holder was there, yeah. And then there's Aretha over there, and then there's Sonia
Sotomayor.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court Justice. Yeah.
And then the guy from Michigan, the senator from Michigan.
Oh, not Carl Levin, maybe.
No, the guy that Conyers.
Oh yeah, John Conyers.
Yeah, John Conyers, yeah. And just so many Elijah Cummings over here, and they're just
everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Really, was nowhere you could look where you didn't. You're going, whoa, is that who I think it is? Whoa, there's so and so. You know, it's like. Yeah.
But this wasn't your first time performing at the White House.
No, it's my second time.
What was the first time?
Under George W. Bush. And mm-hmm. It was for the 25th anniversary of the Thelonious Monk Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a smaller event in the West Wing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, you know I'm really into this stuff. I got afflicted some years ago, and I can't seem to shake it as much as I try. But one of those moments that I've come across in history, back in 69, Richard Nixon, of all people, had this all-star assembly at the White House to give Duke Ellington the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And it was, you know, sort of that first generation of jazz guys who all got together that evening.
Yes.
And, you know, Brubeck and Desmond and yeah. Ellington and a lot of the writers, Whitney Ballett and all these guys. Mm-hmm. And there's a recording from that night that I talked to Christian McBride about a week or two ago when he was in town. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what an incredible night to have been there.
Yes.
And those guys jammed till like 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And I was curious, did you guys get together and hang around and play, or was it like sort of not that kind of
thing? No, it wasn't that kind of party this time.
Yeah.
Times have changed, you know.
Yeah. And,
I guess it's the third time they've done it. Jimmy Carter did one, had an event similar during his administration. And so now Barack, you know, where they acknowledge the importance of the music,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that was wonderful.
When you get together with a group like this, is there a sense there's a certain first among equals? Sort of, is there royalty amidst the royalty there? I mean, Aretha, I'm thinking. Are there certain people that sort of are top rank, and even though you're all sort of in this pantheon here?
Yes. A lot of it has to do with age and generational.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Wayne Shorter, then you got John McLaughlin there.
Yeah.
And Chick.
Korea.
Yeah, Al Jarreau. I mean, it just goes on, and then I got young guys coming up to me, you know, telling me I listened to you since I was in high school.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, get out of here.
Go away.
But it was nice.
Did you have a chance to stroll around the White House and do all that stuff?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. After our, I'll tell you a little story. After our master class with the First Lady, We have escorts to take us in and out, you know. So it was time to go out of the White House and go to our bus back to the hotel. But during all the confusion, I'm hanging out with Terrence. We're trying to get it out together, and kids want to take pictures with you, and I'm taking pictures and signing autographs, blah, 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 blah. And I look around, and I kind of got separated from my escort, you know, and so it's just me and Terrence, and so we're walking, and then he stops and starts talking to one of the soldiers that are mm-hmm. at every door as we go out. So I said, I'll just see you outside, Terrence. So I go outside, and I don't see anybody. So I'm thinking, well, maybe I should go over to the tent, because that's where all the people who know what they're doing are. So I kind of take a left at the back of the White House. And I see these steps, so I come up, and I figure I'm just going to walk over to the tent. I got up to the top of them steps and hit the driveway heading to the White House, and out of this little booth came two armed to the teeth soldiers, Secret Service. Sir, what are you doing here? I said, I'm lost. You know?
They said, come with me.
They escorted me right back down to the gate. You know?
Oh, that's really funny.
Oh,
wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah.
Well, I want to listen to a little music, give our listeners a sense of what this evening sounded like. You played with one guy, Jamie Cullum, along with several others in one song on Friday night. Tell us about Jamie Cullum. He's clearly a remarkable guy.
Yes, he's the Harry Connick of Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
He plays piano and sings, got the show tunes. And
had you met him before?
No, I hadn't.
You know?
He was very nice. All the cats were really loving.
Did you rehearse or did you just go out there and
clean? Oh, no, we rehearsed. We rehearsed several times.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
It's unusual for guys like you.
Yeah. Oh, I was happy they did.
Let's listen to Bobby Watson, Jamie Cullum, and a whole bunch of others on Friday night from the White House.
Goodbye, and amen. Here's hoping we'll meet now and then. It was great fun, but it was just one of those
Bobby Watson, Jamie Cullum, live Friday night from the White House. Who decided who got to play with who? How did that work?
John Beasley, he was the musical director.
Yeah.
And he did a fantastic job of pairing, you know, everyone.
Could you put in requests, or was it you just were at the whims
of
him?
No, I just, wherever y'all want to put me, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Just as long as I get a picture with the president.
And you got that, it sounds
like. And we
like.
Got that. So.
Yeah, yeah. So what's after you play at the White House, how do you recover from that? Like how do you go on? What's the next thing you're looking forward to? Yeah.
Graduation day at UMKC.
Oh, there you go. There you go. A very different kind of event.
That's right.
Sounds like you had a heck of a good time.
It was wonderful.
Well, Bobby Watson, director of UMKC's jazz program, just back from the White House where he played for the first couple and a whole bunch of other people. Always good to visit with you, Bobby.
You too, Steve.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was the great Bobby Watson talking with Steve Kraske in May of this year. You can listen to previous programs and download our podcasts at kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Up to Date is off Monday, but be sure to listen as KCUR presents Intelligence Squared. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. Today's segments were originally produced with help from Lisa Rodriguez, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Caperton Morton. We had help this week from KCUR's Linda Scher and Suzanne Hogan. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a very happy new year, everyone. I'm Danny Alexander, and you are up to date.